Yo team, so here's some random rummaging of a pertinent nature. I'm in Bali, but when you hear this, I'll be in the air driving first from Ahmed Beach in Bali to Denpasar Airport, then flying to Taiwan, then flying to San Francisco, then a short stopover, and then Saturday home. There we go. So there are so many ways of traveling. So let's put our paddle in the underworld ghost river. There we are. So I'm much to reflect on in Bali. I'm reading a pretty adorable book, The World Odyssey of a Balinese Prince by Idana Pucci. And it ends with an important pertinent to us now. So many years have passed since that hospital night in September 2007 when Dr. General Watts stopped in unison with his heart. In that strange moment, it seemed as if the world of Bali's mysteries that I had been privileged to witness also drifted away with him. In earlier days, stepping onto the island seemed like entering another dimension. It felt as if creation had favored and blessed that unique corner of the planet. For years, I had been held in a stupor of wonder, watching suspenseful tragedies and comedies unfold from season to season under the great volcano in the timeless cycle of karma. Now, I look back at this rich, ancient culture that once I knew so well, and I fail to recognize it. Radical change has mutated Balinese society. So many people now seem disoriented, as if they have lost their way in a bad dream, unable to identify even the most familiar road. They grope in confusion as speculation, short-term profit, and pirate behavior have invaded their lives. Perhaps even Dr. Jalantic would no longer recognize his island that President Nehru called the dawn of the world. But the doctor, unlike myself, would most likely accept the status quo with quiet wisdom. On the great national stage, the hope for a new enlightened president of Indonesia was dashed. The ancient Jalantic Kris that had contributed its esoteric magic energy to bring to power the reformist president did not ensure honest and good governance. He fell prey to corruption like so many politicians before him. However, the magic Kris probably had simply a delayed action because the current president appears to be different from those who have preceded him. He governs with surprising transparency and is loved by the poor for trying to break the endemic corruption that has cursed the country, while forcing businesses and billionaires to pay taxes and minimum wages while respecting workers' rights. Dr. Jalantic would have been pleased. But the big question is, will the president survive the campaign of generals, oligarchs, and Islamic extremists aligned against him? So this is all pertinent to us. And then part of the Balinese medicine goes on. The bombs that shook Bali in 2002, forcing the people to face a renewed awareness, did not have the consequences so many had hoped. The doctor was right to view that enlightened moment with skepticism. And what happened then, this is me chiming back in, is there was a national conversation about what in us had allowed this great tragedy to occur. Did we deviate from our values? And she says, in the last decade, a colossal tsunami of greed has crashed upon the island shores. The extraordinary centuries-old culture that evolved day and night, lit by the sun and the moon, seems to have closed in on itself like a clam, surviving perhaps only in those few corners of the island where the vegetation still flourishes. Ah, me again. I was very lucky. I was very, very, very lucky. I have been very lucky. Very Jupiter, traveling in luck, traveling in luck. Beautiful, beautiful Evelyn Roberts, the organizer of our Bali retreat, has created a wonderful haven of all that is good there. We go on. The legendary world of ancestors is being submerged in this modern flood. The island is being stripped of its soul. Yeah, you go into Ubud. I think I was here 10 years ago, which was pretty traffic then, but now, right. And as she says, reduced to another famed escape on the global holiday map with its endless bazaar of cheap trinkets, shoddy bars offering alcohol and drugs, and cement labyrinths encircled by never-ending traffic jams. That's true. Dr. Jalantic's unique culture has devolved into a pale shadow of itself. But we're gonna, you know, magic is everywhere. Magic is everywhere. I did encounter many people who'd been here for decades and were quite bitter, I think we'd say. We understandably so. So today, many years after the prince's birth and just over a decade after his death, the karma of the island seems to be caught in a vicious circle dominated by the inevitable problems of modernity: abundant garbage, mountains of plastic, and dramatic spikes in cancer and obesity. In 2010, authorities began lamenting that the island was overbuilt, but they did nothing. Privately, instead, they handed out construction permits to whomever could pay New York prices. Every year, new hotels rose on precious green rice land, so that now 6,000 hotels are ready to welcome 4 million foreign visitors. Well, this is also, how shall we travel? How shall we travel so as not to add to the misery? How do we compost the sneaky virus of colonialism, a fending off of wonder? That's me. Now, back to Idana. Now a sea of advertising billboards lines every road. Storefronts, not every road, storefronts have leapt up like mushrooms. Gray, lifeless concrete has swallowed thousands of hectares of farmland. Precious water is rationed in Denpasar, while golf courses stay green for high-rolling tourists. The entire southern coast has become one urban sprawl. We go, yes, it is a drought here. It is parched everywhere. Anything anywhere is everywhere, and there's drought. It is rainy season here now. You can hear the ocean. I'm on my beautiful gazing at Stairway to Heaven in Ahmed. It is gorgeous. But so not everywhere, but there we go. Magic, we can find it and tap into it, as we are all aspiring to do now. But yeah, it's the drought, global climate crisis. May humans have manners again. And that was what was so powerful about the Balinese conversation and their form of collective intelligence. You know, did we deviate away? What in us was a Velcro attractor for this great harm that happened in the bombing? You go, yes, so there's that. Where today, a surreal mass of shops, cafes, hotels, restaurants, and gas stations crowd the land from Congo to Seminyak, from Kuta to Sanur, all the way up into the hills to Ubud, where Dr. Jalantic's house once stood, full of charm, enshrining the masterpiece by the great Balinese painter Gusti Kobat, with a garden pavilion framed by an explosion of hibiscus, now looms an immense four-story commercial center, complete with escalators and thousands of multicolored neon lights. Well, we call upon the magic everywhere. We aspire to travel with respect. As she says, you know, we live in the time of Kali Yuga, said a friend of hers, the last of the four epochs, each forming one full cycle through which the universe must pass before it can regenerate itself. According to our Hindu faith, this is a time in which civilization degenerates spiritually. But one day, you will see, or we will see, the gods of Mount Agon will awake the mountain again in furious anger. Well, that's been happening, he warned, looking at the dormant volcano. The Balinese will then be shaken back to their senses, but it may be too late. Well, we're going to add some things to this. By then, all the inner power of Taksu of their culture will have vanished. May have vanished. We are all excavating deep down, as we look at, you know, the horrors of modern world and go, what did this want to be before it got hoodwinked and bamboozled and became an imprisoning rather than a liberating dynamic? And that's where we also want to explore, you know, ritual versus superstition. Everything can be a liberating or an imprisoning. She says, Gusti Raka was deeply saddened by the scandalous illegal sand extraction from the holy mountain that had already begun. And she goes on with many horrors. Yes. And here's what she says. Bali has always been the crystallization of invisible forces in constant communication with daily life, in which the good and the bad are holding hands. No, we're going to spiral into collaborative cahooting. Each Balinese, independently from his or her caste of birth, we're going to come back to that, priesthoods and castes, oh, perhaps that is a complicity that attracts ill fate, is aware of this and grows up behaving accordingly. Meanwhile, ceremonies unfold everywhere and are more grandiose than ever. Each Galungun, the feast in the Balinese calendar of 210 days that marks the gods' descent among the people, The Balinese who work far from home always return to their villages. Globalization might have brought vulgarity and obsessive materialism, but it has not succeeded in destroying the strength of the family and the importance of community. And in her book also, which is a delineation of the Balinese prince, the great doctor who did so much good in the world, you know, and when he dies, he insists that his cremation be in the humble farmer's realm. And so they pull a trickster move, you know, all the royalty are lined up and going to the, you know, important royal realm where thousands and thousands of what we would call dollars are spent. And he goes, no, no, no. And so they, at a certain point, according to his instructions, they escape. They go with his body and pull left to the farmer's thing, just as a final statement of a willingness for democratic equality. And back to Idana. An ancient culture is by its very nature complicated. I would add complex. And as in fairy tales, beauty is at the mercy of negative forces. I play with all these things. The reason for the increased religious fervor in this time of Kali Yuga is a continual attempt to keep the gods happy. Everyone knows that the race for money cannot succeed without injuring the environment as well as the original values of society. Yeah, anything, anywhere is everywhere. Everyone knows that the island belongs to the gods and that the Balinese are simply its custodians. And experience has shown that calamities such as the devastating eruption of the great volcano in 1963, yeah, many people died, and even the bombs of 2002 are ways the gods chose to punish them and awaken their consciousness. We want to play with these things. Now more than ever, people fear the anger of their gods, and so try in every way to appease them with prayers and magnificent handcrafted offerings and scented incense. And I would say that the magic is here. We have to dig for it with kindness and humility. In their hearts, all Balinese know that the island has lost its harmony and balance. Mostly. In the battle between negative and positive, might want to compost battle. The battles are always lost. The needle of the scale has shifted away from the good. The Bali of Dr. Jalantic that once was is no more. And while many Balinese have heard through the news the larger world is also spinning out of control, the people still feel a sense of security from their generosity towards the gods. Their sacred masks come alive only when worn by dancers performing to entertain the gods during their earthly visit. But behind those masks lies the truth. And as a sidebar, also, you know, again, the history as we travel, it's important to know the stories and the history. You know, it was the late 60s when, you know, U.S.-backed death squads roamed through Bali, killing thousands and thousands of people on a very small population island. The killing farmers who were like, could we talk about democracy and land? No. And what is an important horror is that the U.S.-backed death squads, as they moved in to kill people, they wore the sacred masks, the sacred Barong Ket forest god mask. Again, who's got the grail? Who's got the masks? Who has the power? So, just to finish with Idana, she goes, Bali has taught me the art of self-control. I can say today that I've watched closely the folly of human greed and now suffer in the face of so much defilement. I've met a number of these people. At the same time, I've witnessed so many moments of wonder and enchantment. Still here, admired objects of rare artistic beauty. Yes, we have no art, we simply do everything beautifully. Which is true, it's still true. And have been moved by the sensational magic of nature. Bali has taught me the art of self-control and the capacity to behave at my best on any occasion while always respecting my own cultural identity. Yeah, right. Well, yes, we had some spectacular bad manners in our group and some spectacular wonderfulness as well. Manners. The purpose of art is to invite power into the world and offer it a template, inviting it to magnetize that. And that is strong, and that is available to all of us. Back to Idana. It has also taught me the importance of symbols and rituals, giving me the means to feel at ease in all circumstances and with people from all walks of life. Idana, my friend, the gentle doctor, would often tell me, in life we must strive to become good ancestors. Never forget the words, Tri Hita Karana, the cornerstones of Balinese wisdom. living in harmony with the divine among humans and in nature. Deep down, Dr. Jelantic knew that the ancient philosophy of life had been betrayed, and perhaps he would not have been surprised when Mount Elgon suddenly rumbled to life on August 13, 2017. The gods unleashed their anger. All the ceremonies in those last years had not placated them. Rolling plumes of ash soared 2 miles into the purple sky. The airport shut down. Tourists canceled their vacations. President Jokowi traveled to Bali to show the world that all was under control and open again for business, but the volcano erupted again. And before I went to Bali on this long trip that is now drawing to a close, I can feel home calling, but I went and stayed with my wonderful friend Mayumi Oda on the Big Island of Hawaii with her ohana, her beautiful family, and the incredible paradise, apparently, that she'd kept. But we also hosted her son on our trickster call, in which he said, "No, not paradise. The volcano Pele is angry. The vog, the sulfuric acid, often lingers. We looked around the world for maybe another paradise, but we'd put 20 years into this place, and there is no other paradise. There is no paradise. It's all what we make it." And so, Adana continues, "In 1963, when Dr. Jelantic was responsible for saving so many lives during the last eruption, people refused to leave their villages. And contrary to the official statistics, over thousands suffocated in the deadly ash. Now, entire communities crowded into shelters, waiting for the gods' wrath to subside. Many tried to pray at the Mother Temple Besaki. The pull of the invisible world put them at risk from the primordial forces of nature. The cycle of karma spun. The island resting atop the turtle's back shook violently. Months later, the volcano fell silent, and life continued anew in this changed world. Personally, I feel that something eternally mysterious will always exist in Bali. Yes, but only those who seek shall find. As my compatriot Giorgio Vasari wrote 5 centuries ago about the so-called hidden Leonardo behind his own enormous fresco dominating the Hall of 500 in Florence." So it's a worthy book. That's just the very, very end of it. There were other passages that are marked, we'll see. Here's the piece too. "Dr. Jelantic's last wish, our sweet prince did not want the pomp required of his princely status, which all his other relatives craved. For them, the glorious feudal days had not faded." Right, feudalism, caste system, priesthoods, perhaps as tricksters we offer that into the cauldron. You know, it is everywhere. You know, again, what is respect and what is reverently irreverent in a liberating fashion? You know, this is an island that had for the long, long time, cockfighting. You know, we wear sashes around our waist when we go to the holy places to separate our higher selves from our lower animal selves, and I go, I don't know about that exactly. You know, when on my wall here at Amat are beautiful paintings of Balinese making love in the fields, unashamed, you know. And again, the priesthood realm, it's just something for us to consider. So, Dr. Jelantic knew that the cremation ceremony represented the great financial burden on every family. On this day, he wanted to send a message to the Balinese. I can hear his words. "You don't have to spend your life savings to cremate your loved ones. Do it simply. If I can do it, so can you." So, beautiful, beautiful. And much beauty. And we're here to, you know, invite that as well. There's more part two as I rummage around to offer this to the team. Yes, here we go. This will be part one. Let me just keep going. Okay, here we go. This is informal for our team. The Balinese retreat had a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful place with beautiful, beautiful humans as helpmates and organized quite wonderfully. And our team was pretty darn good and perfect. Our theme was dancing with demons, and there were plenty of those, hungry ghosts, a skosh of churlishness into the cauldron. you know, the category of no matter what, no matter what, no matter how many yoga classes one's taken or entheogens one has taken, does not necessarily mean anything. You know, may the inner journey and the outer journey be one. So what was offered, you know, I've said so many things throughout the years, but I still say them again because there's so much in them. Magic is a willingness to cooperate with everything. Yes, how shall we do that? What does that mean? How do we embody it? Not condone, but Sufi Aikido spiraling, you know, that we are all responsible for our responses, and we throw reactions into the cauldron. So magic is a willingness to cooperate with everything. It is an aspiration. It is something I hold dear. And autonomy is a sacrament. You know, so even in our group, there was a full moon ritual I had set in motion. And yet, there I was, hearing it remotely, going, oh, well, it's okay. It's all right what they're doing. There's some bad drumming, you know, okay, and some howling that doesn't seem quite right. And but where I was sitting on the stoops of my glorious, open, breezy room, you know, and Jackie, the white spirit dog, a great companion, came and sat beside me, and we gazed at the moon. I go, this is it. This is where I want to be. And beautiful member of our team, Ola, was singing from her balcony, and I go, ooh, right. No obligation. May we be autonomous and be where we're meant to be, right? So the miracle of travel, you know, is story. It's Jupiter, story. Syncretism is a blessing. You know, the tale of Mushkil Gusha, which I think I sent to everybody, but, you know, I can always tell again. That was me hanging out the window over the rice paddies, you know, last Thursday night when kerfuffles and strangeness and ill manners had fallen upon the group. There we go. And I go, oh, let me tell this story. So I, as best I could remember, I leaned out the window and recorded the tale of Mushkil Gusha. Everything has its story. And, in that tale, which I think you all have, in the imperfect rendering, but sufficient to lift the spells from the group, there we go, some crucial things. The woodcutter, you know, as we remember, begins, you know, once upon a time, not 1,000 miles from here, there lived a poor old woodcutter who was a widower with his little daughter. And he used to go every day into the woods to cut branches and trim them, and then he would carry the wood into market to sell them. When one day his daughter said, Father, I sometimes wish, that we could have more and more interesting kinds of food. Very well, my child, the woodcutter said to his daughter. Tomorrow I will get up extra early, and I will go deeper into the woods, and I will cut a double bundle of wood, and I will take it to market and sell it, and that way we can have more and wonderful different things to eat. Right? So the woodcutter goes forth, you know, and he's cutting and trimming the branches all day, and he comes back late at night. He's tired and hungry, and he knocks on the door saying, Daughter, please open the door. For I am tired and hungry, and I've eaten nothing all day, and I must be rested so I can take the wood into market tomorrow to fulfill your wish. But the little daughter, having forgotten all about the conversation the night before, this is all important, had meanwhile tidied up, eaten supper, and gone to bed. She had been a little worried about her father, but thought that he must have decided to stay in the town. So by now, the woodcutter, even tireder and more hungry, you know, was so sad when he heard above him out of the dawn, you know, a voice that said, hurry, hurry, come this way. If you want enough and you need little enough, you shall have delicious food. So he follows the voice out into the woods, and now he's lost, and there's nothing more happening for him. And he's sad, and he begins to weep, but he realizes that weeping and waily-waily will not help him either. So he decides to tell himself his own story. This is really important. In many fairy tales, many things do not work, and in the fairy tale of our lives right now, many things do not work, weeping and so on, until we sit down and tell ourselves our own story of how we came to be lost in the woods. And that's, you know, for us, micro and macro. How did we humans come to be lost in the woods? So then he hears a voice out of the dawn, right? The telling of our own story opens the world of magic. There we go. And the voice says, "Old man, what are you doing there?" And he goes, "I'm telling myself my own story." "You know, very well," said the voice. "What's that?" And he tells him. And the voice says, "Okay, close your eyes and mount, as it were, a step." This is important, too. And the old man says, "But I don't see a step." "Never mind," said the voice, "and do as I say." So the old man closes his eyes and then does indeed feel something very much like a step under his foot. And he climbs the steps and begins to move. The whole stairway begins to move very fast. And then the voice says, "Now open your eyes." And he finds himself in a vast desert full of stones of every color, black, white, red, and yellow. And the voice says, "Pick up as many of these stones as you can, put them in your satchel, and then descend." So he does that. And he descends and he finds himself outside his little house. And he knocks on the door and his daughter, you know, opens it. And he tries to tell her everything that's happened, but it all sounded so confusing. You know, and he goes in, he says that, and the voice then says, "You have been saved by Mushkal Gusha. He is the remover of all difficulties," kind of like Ganesh. "Your difficulties have been removed by Mushkal Gusha, and you must share some dates," which happened to be the last food that he and his little daughter had in the house, "you know, with someone, with any needy person, or with someone who will help the needy, and tell the tale of Mushkal Gusha, you know, every Thursday night, don't forget," right? So the next Thursday arrives, and as is the way of men, he's forgotten to tell the story. And late that night, his neighbors knock on his door and say, "Oh, woodcutter, neighbor, neighbor, please open the door and give us a light from those marvelous lamps we see shining through the window, because our fire has gone out." He goes, "What? What lights?" And he goes and he sees that the stones in the corner that he'd covered up have turned into precious, luminous gems. So he goes back and he tells the neighbors, "Neighbors, I'm sorry, I have no fire." And he closed the door and their faces, and they went away muttering, but they leave our story here. And so they go, "Oh." So again, he covers them back up so that no one would see what a treasure he had. Also kind of important. And the woodcutter takes the gems one by one to town and always sells them easily for a high price. Now, the woodcutter increasingly, and his daughter increasingly prosperous, builds a castle just opposite the king of their country. And the daughter of the king looks out and sees a marvelous fairy tale castle and goes, and she's indignant. She goes, "What right have these people to do this so close to our home?" And she summons the daughter of the little woodcutter, or the little daughter of the woodcutter. But they soon become fast friends. And they're swimming in a beautiful pond that the king has made for his daughter, having a great time. You know, and then the little daughter of the woodcutter goes home, and the princess cannot find a beautiful and valuable necklace and decides that the little daughter has stolen it. Right? So the king, she goes to her father, the king, and he has the woodcutter's fortune declared forfeit. He has the daughter put into an orphanage, and the woodcutter is put in a town square, chained, with a sign around him that says, "This is what happens to those who steal from kings." At first he was most unhappy, and people jeered and threw things. And then, again, he overhears a man passing by mentioning that it was Thursday. You know, and he goes, "Oh my goodness, it's Thursday night, and I've forgotten to commemorate Mushkal Gusha, the remover of all difficulties." No sooner had this thought come into his mind than a charitable man passing by throws him a tiny coin, to which the woodcutter says, "Good sir, you have given me money which is of no use to me." Remember, Jupiter's wealth, not money. "If, however, your kindness could extend to," oops, it's windy here, "to buying one or two dates and sitting and eating them with me and listening to my story, I would be eternally grateful." So the kind man did that, and they shared dates. And the woodcutter tells his story, and the kind man gets up and says, "I think you must be mad." And he goes home, but he finds that when he's gone home, all of his difficulties have disappeared. And that makes him start to think a great deal about Mushkal Gusha. But he leaves our story here. So that evening, late, the princess decides to go for a late night dip in her pool. And as she's about to dive in, she sneezes and her head goes up and she sees the beautiful, valuable necklace hanging on a branch where she had put it so long ago. So she runs excitedly to her father and explains the situation. He has the woodcutter unchained, the daughter back from the orphanage, the fortune restored, and everybody lives happily ever after. And this is from Idris Shah, Caravan of Dreams, Sufi Tales. And it ends with saying, this is just one of the stories of Mushkil Gosha. It is a very long story, and it has never ended. You know, and it is told everywhere, wherever there are people. You know, and it is because of him, as his story is told, that the people who are in real need will always find their way. Will you repeat the tale of Mushkil Gosha on Thursday nights and share dates with another, or give a gift in the name of Mushkil Gosha to some who will help the needy? No. Yes, you will. So, just, and I couldn't help but tell the whole thing. Why not? So, yes. Now, these deep realms, you know, of the miracle of travel and syncretism and blessing and Mushkil Gosha and everything has its story. You know, some, you know, are superstitious nonsense used to justify caste system and priesthood. And some are Venusian rituals of conscious, reverent collaboration. You know, let us put our talents of discerning, may we all be, you know, samurai love beings, you know. And now is perfect. You know, we each carry a unique and necessary medicine for our times. We reframe whaley-whaley trauma into our beautiful, dangerous assignment. You know, for the citizen, trickster, bodhisattva, coyote, wolf, oti, within and without to succeed. You know, we go, we want a supportive wolf pack. We want many things. And, you know, and may we toss all kerfuffles, personal and collective, into the cauldron and ladle liberating lightning out of the cauldron. Thus, that's it for now, but there's more soon. Woof, woof, woof.